Greetings, listeners and friends of the RAOTC. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, saying welcome to this broadcast for September 2021. I am Bruce, VK3UV, and...
I am Ian, VK3JS.
And together we hope you'll enjoy this bulletin of news and information. This broadcast is relayed on a number of frequencies on the first Monday of the month, except for January. The transmissions emanate from many different sources, and the actual times and frequencies may be found on our website www.raotc.org.au. Now, I would like to thank all of our volunteers who have helped with the relaying of this broadcast. Club news. We have two new members, and they are Tony Preston, VK6CV, previous call sign VK6ZTP, became full RAOTC life member number 1819 on the 11th of August 2021. And we have John Baker, VK3JWC, previous call signs P29WB, VK3BIS, VK1CAY, and VK3CVH, became new full RAOTC member number 1818 on the 20th of July 2021. Annual General Meeting and Melbourne Luncheon. Regrettably, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, it will not be possible to have the usual face-to-face annual general meeting followed by the September luncheon. In accordance with the rules of association, notice is hereby given of the annual general meeting 2021 of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia Incorporated, to be held at 2 p.m. EAST, that's 0400 UTC, on Thursday the 23rd of September 2021, and will be conducted by video conferencing using Zoom. Business. Confirm minutes, adopt accounts, elect committee members. Note, all existing committee members are willing to continue in office and offer themselves for re-election. RAOTC members who wish to participate in the 2021 AGM will need to register beforehand by sending an email to raotc@raotc.org.au no later than Thursday the 9th of September. Those who register will receive an email prior to the AGM advising of the Zoom meeting ID number and the password to enable them to join the AGM, plus the AGM 2021 reports. A nomination form for the committee can be downloaded from our website www.raotc.org.au. The committee hopes that Victorian country and interstate RAOTC members will take this opportunity to participate in the annual general meeting. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. It is part of our charter to present a mix of articles, old and new, topical and newsworthy. So this month, instead of a rehash of old OTN articles, here is something a bit different. We are turning our memory, excuse the pun, back to some computer history. And for the rest of 2021, we hope to present more historical items on this subject. Here is our first item. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. Now here is Ian to present an item of extreme importance, which will affect us all in the not-too-distant future. Thank you, Ian.
Hello, listeners. I trust that you've been keeping well and warm and usefully occupied if you've been involved in lockdowns in recent times since we last met. Here is an article which appeared in ABC Science early in August, Now, you know that normally we make no comments politically, morally, ethically, or any other form. But this article was deemed to be of interest to you and very topical. So I present to you an article entitled, Where and How Will We Get the Metals to Feed Our Future Technology Needs? And it is by environment reporter Nick Kilvert. If you had a ton of ore from a gold mine and a ton of iPhones, which is likely to contain more gold? What about silver? You've probably guessed the reason for the question is that the answer is surprising. And yes, in both cases, it's the devices that are a richer source of the precious metals. In fact, the metals for all Tokyo Olympic and Paralympic medals came from recycled e-waste. Over 2 years, the organisers gathered enough gold, silver and bronze from small electronic devices to make the almost 5,000 medals awarded to the athletes. And it's not just our computers and phones. Everything from electric cars to wind turbines and solar panels, things we need to transition the world to net zero emissions, require an array of metals like silver, palladium, platinum, copper, aluminium and rare earths, such as neodymium. So where will we get them from? Will we have enough? And what role can recycling and reuse play in ensuring we can supply our technology needs into the future? How much are we talking about? With the US under Joe Biden aiming to have its electricity sector carbon pollution free by 2035, the nation is already ramping up a suite of clean energy projects. Last week, US Wind Incorporated put in a bid to build up to 82 wind turbines off the coast of Maryland to supply the grid with an extra 1.2 gigawatts of power. That's part of a plan to install enough wind turbines to supply the US with 30 gigawatts, enough to power 10 million American homes by 2030. Each wind turbine consists of several hundred tons of materials, including anywhere between 2.6 and 6.7 tons of copper per megawatt, according to the Copper Alliance. Other metals in turbines include steel, aluminium and iron, as well as cobalt and rare earths. And those figures are just to supply a fraction of the US grid's power. Natural resource and mining consultancy Wood Mackenzie estimated in 2019, before the Biden administration ramped up climate goals, that globally we'd need more than 5.5 million tons of copper to build wind turbines alone for the following 10 years. For reference, Australia's entire annual copper exports are under 1 million tons. And the amount of copper per megawatt in solar power plants is only marginally less than wind. And there are the world's cars. Scientists agree that to limit catastrophic climate change, we need to get to net zero emissions globally by 2050 at the absolute latest, ideally well before then. That means a transition to 100% electric vehicles. But the roughly 63 million cars sold worldwide in 2020, less than 5% were electric. When we start to consider all the metals involved, nickel, cobalt, lithium, rare earths and silver among them, to build the world's electric vehicles, solar panels, smartphones, computers and batteries, the numbers start to get pretty staggering. Will we run out? Broadly, we can think about two categories of metals: major metals that we already mine and use in large quantities, and the more niche metals, such as cobalt and rare earths. Major metal supply probably won't be an issue, according to Eleanor Lebre of the Sustainable Minerals Institute at the University in Queensland. Quote, in terms of mining, you will require much more mining and major metals because the demand is higher, Dr. Lebrer said. But supply could become an issue for the more niche metals, said Richard Corkish, a solar energy researcher at the University of New South Wales. He says, if we're really going to replace the world's fossil fuels, then really dramatic niche metal production is going to take place, much more than recently. He said solar technology uses a lot of silver, as well as very niche type of low iron sand to achieve its highly transparent glass. Quote, the industry is learning to use less silver, but solar production is expanding. Given that renewable energy supplied just over a quarter of Australia's energy mix in 2020, Australia alone is going to have to quadruple the capacity of its clean energy infrastructure, including hydroelectricity and battery storage, to get close to net zero, end of quote. Dr. Lebrer said that rather than supply, she's more worried about the impact that such intensive mining will have on the environment and vulnerable societies. Quote, I am not really concerned about the supply itself. I'm concerned about the consequences. At the moment, the way mining is done, they're not very good at working with local communities and what they do with the mine itself after it closes. That's the problem. End of quote. Where do our metals come from now? Currently, most of the world's copper comes from Chile, followed by China and Peru, according to Australian minerals exploration company Taruga. Cobalt, which is in many batteries, including those from leading electric car manufacturers, mostly comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC, where child labour and other human rights abuses, as well as environmental degradation, are rife. However, Tesla CEO Elon Musk last year announced a move away from using cobalt in the company's car batteries, although it's still used in many smartphones and other battery-powered devices. One of the leading battery alternatives to cobalt is nickel, with the largest reserves of nickel lying in Indonesia and Australia, according to the US Geological Survey. Then there are rare earths, elements like neodymium and yttrium, which we use in the smartphone displays, LED lights, flat-screen televisions, and computer displays. The lion's share of rare earth reserves are in China. Quote, China is very much keeping a monopoly over rare earths, Dr. Lebrer said. If they wanted to constrain supply, they could. There have been other countries that have done stuff like that, end of quote. But across China and Inner Mongolia, rare earth mining has left behind toxic tailings, dams, and evaporation ponds. In some cases, they have overflowed into waterways and leached into groundwater. There are significant rare earth reserves in Australia too. Although Australia has stricter environmental compliance than countries such as China, mining here can still have significant environmental impacts.
We'll just take a little break here. You are tuned to VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia Incorporated. Now back to Ian.
An Australian company, for instance, has run into a local opposition in Malaysia. That company mines rare earth ores in Western Australia and exports them to Malaysia, where their processing leaves behind slightly radioactive waste. If mining of rare earths and other metals such as lithium and copper is going to expand in Australia, Dr. Lebrer said the industry as a whole needs to improve its environmental accountability. Quote, in Australia, you have tens of thousands of abandoned mines. Abandonment of mines still happens now. You have mines that are put on care and maintenance and that's it. End of quote. What is the role of recycling? There's a pervasive myth that renewable energy technologies like solar panels can't be recycled. Like most myths, it's based on a kernel of truth, according to Dr. Corkish. The difficulty in recycling solar panels comes down to the clear coating that encapsulates the panels, ethylene vinyl acetate. However, there are several methods, thermal, chemical, and mechanical, of removing this coating. The major issue, though, especially as the coat of solar panels continues to drop, is that it's cheaper to buy new panels than recycle the older ones. The solution, as is the case with recycling many types of materials, needs to be policy-driven. There you are, certainly something for you to think about. A quite important problem, in fact. Thank you.
You are tuned to VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, Incorporated. 40 years later, what was it like to use an IBM PC in 1981? This is an edited version of the original article written by Ben J. Edwards in How to Geek, published on the 12th of August 2021. 40 years ago, on August the 12th, 1981, IBM introduced the very first IBM personal computer, also known as the IBM PC Model 5150. It sold well and set standards that are still with us today. It's late 1981, and when you're ready to buy, IBM gives you a wide variety of configuration options that vary based on RAM and internal controller cards that allow the use of floppy drives, color graphics, a game controller, a serial port, or a parallel port. There's no IBM-provided hard drive option. That will come later with the IBM PC XT in 1983. But no matter what the configuration, the PC always ships with an Intel 8088 CPU running at 4.77 MHz. Typical IBM PC 5150 configurations range from a bare-bones model with a 16 kilobyte of RAM, a monochrome graphics monitor, a keyboard, and no floppy drives for $1,565. And that's now about $4,500 in today's money. To a 64K RAM unit with color CGA graphics, two double-sided floppy drives, and an Epson MX printer for $4,500. And converting that to today's money, that's about $13,500. The maximum RAM the IBM PC can use at launch is 256K. But later cards will expand the system up to 640K of RAM. Even with that settled, you could still buy a monitor, $345 for the monochrome version, much more for colour, and an operating system. IBM PC-DOS, developed by Microsoft and also sold as MS-DOS, is available at launch for about $40. With CPM-86, about $140, arriving in April 1982, and USCD Pascal P system after that. Now that you have your IBM PC, the first thing you want to do is pull the various components out of their shipping boxes and set them on your disk. If you bought any expansion cards that weren't pre-installed at the retailer, you need to open the main IBM PC unit with a screwdriver and install them. Once that's settled, the system is fairly simple to hook up. It's finally time to start up your IBM PC. The PC comes with the IBM Basic programming language built in, so if you want to use that, no disk is required. If your unit has a disk drive, pull the PC-DOS 5.25-inch boot disk from its jacket and insert it into the drive. After a moment, you'll see an A prompt on the screen. Type the DIR command and you'll see the contents of the disk. Using PC-DOS is slightly tricky if you don't know what you're doing. You need to memorise simple commands like dir to show the contents of the disk and copy to copy files. PC DOS 1 doesn't support subdirectories, so there's no need to CD to change directories yet. That will come in 1983 with PC DOS 2. To run a program, either boot it directly from a disk and it will run automatically with no operating system necessary, or find its .exe or .com file and run it by typing the file name at the A prompt and hitting enter. Imagine it's 1983 and you want to run the PC's first killer app, Lotus 123, a popular spreadsheet program. Just insert the disk, power up the system, type 123 and hit enter to start the program. Printing the results. You spent all last night typing up a report or working on a spreadsheet and you need to share the results with your boss and co-workers. With no local area network, LAN, at your office, few options for modem-to-modem transfers, and few people with PCs, the best way to do that is by printing your work out on paper. Luckily, you got a brand new IBM 5152, a rebadged Epson MX80 dot matrix printer, when you bought your PC. In our hypothetical scenario, so you hook it up to the parallel port on your PC. The printer screeches away, printing text line by line using a couple of pins that strike an inked ribbon. The print comes out on tractor feed paper. At least you can relax and know that you've put in a full day's work. The IBM PC will be waiting and ready for you to do it all again tomorrow. Why was the IBM PC platform so successful? Vestiges of the IBM PC standard remain as the underpinnings of the modern Windows and Intel platform used by billions of people around the world. How did IBM PC pull this off when dozens of other computer platforms like Atari, Commodore, Macintosh, DEC, CPM didn't? The historical consensus usually includes four main factors. A. The IBM brand name encouraging heavy early adoption. B. The IBM PC's open nature. The quick rise of 100% compatible clone machines. And D. The continued release of faster, backwards compatible CPUs from Intel. IBM made three stunning decisions when designing the IBM PC. The first was that IBM leaned on existing software developers in the microcomputer industry like Microsoft, instead of exclusively writing its own software. IBM also utilized off-the-shelf chips, such as the 8088 CPU from Intel, instead of rolling its own. The third was that IBM provided extensive documentation that allowed developers to craft both hardware accessories and software for the platform without the need for a license. All these play to IBM's advantage. By using off-the-shelf software and hardware, it could pull from the best minds in the personal computer industry and piece together a machine only 13 months of development time. And by keeping things open like the Apple II, third parties would quickly provide the hardware add-ons and software library that made the IBM PC platform essential. Some of that openness came back to haunt IBM and with the rise of the PC clones, fueled by ever more powerful backward compatible Intel CPUs and operating systems from Microsoft. But those clones were what made the platform into a true industry standard. The original 1981 PC often gets flack from its uninspired design, but it was a durable, flexible, modular, expandable workhorse. If one part broke, you could easily swap it out for another with a screwdriver, and with a great software library appearing within a few years of its launch. You could get real work done with it. In 2011, I spent 3 days using the original IBM PC in an attempt to do modern work with the system. In the process, I found the IBM PC 5150 to be a solid, reliable machine. Its high-quality keyboard made text-based tasks pleasant, and its large software library allowed me to get only a 4.77 MHz CPU. The fact that the IBM PC I use still worked after so many decades was a testament to its build quality. In fact, the PC still boots just fine 10 years later and looks almost new. We now come to the end of this month's session, and we know you await with bated breath and rabid anticipation to our joke presentation. So here it is. I was walking down the street when I was accosted by a particularly dirty and shabby-looking homeless man who asked me for a couple of dollars for dinner. I took out my wallet, extracted $10 and asked, "If I give you this money, will you buy some beer with it instead of dinner?" "No, I had to stop drinking years ago," the homeless man replied. "Will you use it to go fishing instead of buying food?" I asked. "No, I don't waste time fishing," the homeless man said. "I need to spend all of my time trying to stay alive." "Will you spend this on hunting equipment?" I asked. "Are you nuts?" replied the homeless man. "I haven't gone hunting in 20 years. "Well," I said, "I am not going to give you money. Instead, I'm going to take you home for a shower and a terrific dinner cooked by my wife." The homeless man was astounded. "Won't your wife be furious with you for doing that?" I replied, "Don't worry about that. It is important for her to see what a man looks like after he has given up drinking, fishing and hunting." Thank you for listening. Ian and I hope that you have found something of interest. Next month, we will present another article of computer historical interest. So until then, and all being well, we shall be back with you on Monday, the 6th of October, 2021. A reminder, the online Zoom annual general meeting and 6 monthly meeting will be held at 2 p.m. VK3 time on the Thursday, the 23rd of September. Please don't forget to register for the online Zoom meeting no later than Thursday, the 9th of September. Send your request to raotc at raotc.org.au. This is a great opportunity for our country and interstate members to join in and have a say in what is happening within the raotc. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, saying 73, and listening now for any check-ins and callbacks for those relay stations that have an operator available. Thank you.